you assume when you call a customer service line for a credit card or a bank or insurance, it's your call is answered in the order it's received. But in fact, that's not the case. We all have what's called a CLV or a customer lifetime value. And that's based on, you know, maybe how much our balance is on the credit card or how much we have in the bank or how much the property that's insured is. And that CLV can determine how quickly your call is answered.
I'm Essin Zafar, and welcome to another episode of Unfair Nation, the podcast that discusses our nation's rising inequity and social, political, and economic inequality, what it means for you, and what you can do about it. Every other week, we interview one person to get their perspective on structural inequality, and today I'm joined by Nelson Schwartz, a reporter in New York City. So, almost all of us have to work really, really hard to get into good schools, and we need to have a job or some kind of medical insurance to get medical care. But what happens when you can buy the best medical care or entrance for your kids into elite universities and colleges? What does that mean for sick patients and students who don't have access to the same resources? And are we being priced out of American social, economic, and public institutions by a velvet rope economy? That's what my guest today is going to answer. His name's Nelson Schwartz, and he is an award-winning economics reporter for the New York Times, and he's also the author of a recent book called The Velvet Rope Economy. Before we get to the interview, though, thank you to our growing number of listeners. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to our podcast. Be sure to leave us a review on Apple's podcast app or your favorite service. All right, let's get started with a conversation with Nelson. Hey, listen, thanks for joining. Appreciate it. You just recently finished writing The Velvet Rope Economy. I've been hearing all about it on NPR every time Every time there's a commercial break on NPR, they talk about the Velvet Rope Economy. And as somebody who studies and thinks about inequality, I was like, I have to read the book, and then second, I had to get you on the podcast. So thanks for joining.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So tell me a little bit about why you decided to write the book, and maybe what the Velvet Rope Economy is.
Basically, the velvet rope economy, to me, is the system by which everything in consumer life is more and more tiered and stratified and divided by what you can pay. And this could be 9 different lines to board a plane. It could be going to a theme park, going to a concierge doctor and getting a fast track to see a specialist, and just the different ways people can jump the line based on what they spend. And I think what intrigued me about it is once you're aware of it or once it's pointed out, you begin to see it everywhere, even in areas where you didn't really see it years ago, like medicine or high school athletics or even on board ship, things have become much more divided and tiered according to class than in the 70s and 80s. And it just seemed to me that it said something larger about the way we were living in society and this sort of the ability of, people with money to jump the line, and that it seemed like there was a book there.
So I'd like to get into some of these examples you talked about, which are fascinatingly portrayed in your book. But I don't know if you know the answer to this, but I was curious, why is it called the velvet rope? Is there a historical reason for this, or is this just from, old-timey Hollywood where they used to have these velvet ropes? I mean, where does that come from, that term?
I think what I had in mind was the velvet rope that you had in front of a club, a nightclub like Studio 54 in the 70s. And there'd be a lot of people waiting to get into the club. And then, for a fortunate few, the bouncer would lift the velvet rope and let them in. And that seemed like what was going on, except in this case, the fortunate few just had money. and it raised questions of fairness, and that was the velvet rope that I had in mind.
So there's an element of, based on the example you're talking about, there's an element of people trying to get in. It's not just a, you have something I don't, it's you have something I don't, and I really, really want that something. There's an aspirational element to this.
Yes, yes, I think there is. And I think, you know, people do aspire to sort of that special treatment. You know, I think that's part of it beyond the monetary element. People, you know, want to feel like they're on the inside and they're in the select lucky few. And I think it's, as I write in the book, in certain circumstances, it's very seductive when you can afford to be on the inside and the velvet rope parts and makes way for you.
Haven't we always had a velvet rope economy? I mean, we've had first class on airplanes and other similar environments where some people, if you pay enough, you get better treatment, faster treatment.
You know, I think there have always been elements of this, but what struck me was sort of what changed was kind of the cruise ship metaphor. I mean, 120 years ago on the Titanic, you had, you know, different social classes, and it was pretty rigid to the point which there were gates between the classes, and whether you lived or died after the ship hit the iceberg depended in part on what class you were in. So that was pretty severe. But in the sort of post-war era, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, things on board ship became, you know, more egalitarian. Obviously, different people had different sized rooms. But outside the room, everyone mixed. There wasn't, you know, a ship within a ship like there is now. And, you know, you had, you know, people freely moving about the vessel. And if you watched, I'm dating myself, but if you watched The Love Boat, which was on in the 70s and 80s, you know, everyone mixed on board ship in the dining rooms and the common areas. Now on Norwegian, there's this ship within a ship called The Haven. On Royal Caribbean, there's suites class, which is they have different areas just for people in suites. And I think you see this kind of segregation in a way that is, did not exist 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And I think that's what's new.
So in your opinion, are we headed back to that Gilded Age of the kind of Titanic?
Yeah, I think if we're not headed back, we may already be there. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, people don't even come into contact with one another from different classes today. I mean, that's what's scary. And, you know, what's scary is you see this in kind of all different kinds of areas. I noticed it back, you know, before the pandemic, when you can go to the movies at AMC, at the movie theater, they have this AMC A-list where if you're, you know, you're paying up or you belong to like a frequent flyer group or something like that, you can get your popcorn first and you get admitted first. And just things like that, you know, basically, again, it's the segregation where people don't even come into contact with people who are different from them.
So give me an example of what that looks like maybe on a cruise line or a cruise ship. I think you talk about it a little bit in your book, but it'd be great for, I think, people to hear what it looks like.
Sure. You know, on Royal Caribbean, you have two restaurants next to one another, Coastal Kitchen and... I'm just trying to remember, and Windjammer. And the difference is Windjammer is for everyone, and it sort of has chafing dishes, and it's crowded. Everybody's, you know, kind of congregating around, getting food. And then you have Coastal Kitchen, which has white tablecloths, is calm and quiet. And Coastal Kitchen is only for suites guests. But what was interesting to me, and sort of psychologically notable, is to get to Windjammer, you have to pass by Coastal Kitchen. So you see what you can't partake of. I mean, there's frosted glass windows, so you can't really see in. But you pass by, and the cruise ship feels like, you know, I would worry that this would, you know, build up resentment. But they say, no, it creates a marker and an aspiration. People say, oh, you know, next time I take a cruise, I want to be in the suites class so I can go to Coastal Kitchen.
Do you think it builds up resentment? Because, I mean, that's when I'm thinking of this, I'm feeling resentful and I'm not on the cruise ship right now. You know, I, there's an element of unfairness to it. Do you think, let's take their, what they're saying about the cruise ships at face value. Do you think this system nonetheless creates this kind of resentment in other industries? I mean, you talk about this concept of envy, right, in the book.
Yeah. There's sort of benign envy and malignant envy. Benign envy is the Coastal Kitchen windjammer situation where you say, oh, you know, that looks good. I want to do that next time. Malignant envy is where there's real resentment. And the cruise industry is very adept at measuring and studying consumer behaviors. And they've done a lot of research. What they found is if you have people in the same restaurant and one group of patrons is being treated differently and getting faster service, that creates malignant envy, whereas separate restaurants does not. So that's just sort of their experience. I mean, if you want to see, you know, malignant envy at work, you can see it in terms of air rage, on airplanes. And, you know, a study found that when there's business class in proximity to coach, you have a much higher odds of an air rage incident.
Yeah, you discuss United, there was this famous incident several years ago with United Airlines where this, I think, physician was taken off the air or taken out of the airplane. And you, I think you mentioned that, right, in your book.
Yeah. Actually, if he had been an elite frequent flyer, he wouldn't have been pulled off the plane. So, I mean, people say, you know, what does it mean to have elite status? They can look you up. And I think that's something, the informational aspect of a lot of this is profound. There's even an app on some airlines where the stewardesses or flight attendants can look at the status of all the different passengers and know who to, you know, go and check and see if they need another cup of coffee. I mean, the amount of information that businesses have, you know, really gives them a leg up in providing special treatment. And I think that guy who got pulled off, would never have been pulled off had he had elite status.
One of the trends I noticed was between the division between optional spaces and kind of mandatory public spaces. And, you know, the less that wealthy people take advantage of a public space, the worse off it gets, right? Because they're not contributing to it. And they're creating their own optional spaces. You know, maybe you want to discuss the example of the which I thought was fascinating, was the helicopter story of these executives traveling from LA to SF using their own personal transportation system.
Sure. You know, one thing I've noticed is that as the kind of public spaces have become more difficult, more congested, more of a hassle, the elite withdraw and sort of move into their own spaces and where they can bypass that congestion. In New York, you see this with Blade, which is a helicopter service, which you can go from Manhattan to JFK in 15 minutes, and it'll deposit you right by your plane in a chopper. Normally, that could take 2 hours in rush hour congestion, and they just bypass it. And I think there's a public policy implication that it's sort of when the elite can sort of bypass these problems, there's less of an impulse to deal with it and to address it. In California, there's a private service called Blackbird, which matches people with seats on private aircraft. And what it does is it uses smaller airports like Santa Monica or Palo Alto, as opposed to LAX or San Francisco International, which are very congested. And you'll sort of use these smaller airports, use private planes. And it's more expensive than a budget flight, but it's competitive with, you know, a more expensive regular flight, mm-hmm. but you bypass the hassle. And I mean, it's an intelligent business idea, but again, I just worry what, from a public policy standpoint, what does it do when the elite and when people who are campaign contributors and other sort of decision makers and shapers of public policy, when they don't have to deal with the hassles that the rest of us deal with, what is the net result?
Is there anything that shows that lack of insight by some of these powerful and wealthy people does result in a deterioration of public spaces?
Well, I just think the fact that you've had, you know, just, you know, airports, you know, falling apart, and you've had, you know, congestion to get to the airport reaching, you know, several hours in L.A. or New York. Just the fact that that's developed at the same time you have these services spring up to sort of bypass it, you know, makes me wonder if there's a connection there.
There was two stories that really struck me. The first one was the story of you going to Disneyland. And you went, I think, with your daughter to Disneyland, and you got the elite treatment. So I wonder first if you can share that story, you know, what that was like. And then secondly, you know, what impact, if any, you think it had on your daughter, and then what that means for, you know, what the velvet rope economy and the growth of this economy means for kids, because I thought that was really interesting for young people.
Sure. Well, I tried out the VIP tour at Disney.
On your own dime, huh?
Yes. And wow.
How much was that, if you don't mind me asking, approximately?
It's $500 to $700 an hour.
Wow.
And well, actually, for Disney, unlike Yankee, Disney actually comped me. So I didn't actually pay for Disney.
Okay.
They sort of treated to me for free.
Yeah.
But it's $500 to $700 an hour. And for a minimum of something like 7 or 8 hours. So it's quite expensive. But it's really like from another world. I mean, they meet you in a van, and the van, the tour guide puts stickers on the van to delight my daughters. And you don't wait on a single line. I mean, and you go up the back way for these different rides.
It's faster than FastPass. Just beats up fast.
Yeah,
FastPass is nothing compared to this, right?
Right. I mean, even sometimes the line at FastPass was too long, and we just went right to the front. It was kind of cringeworthy, you know, at times when we walked in front of people.
Did they react? I mean, we talked about the cruise ship industry. When you walked in front of people, you felt embarrassed. But did
right.
you see any reactions on their behalf?
I saw people looking at us like sort of surprised we were walking in front of them, but I didn't have any reactions like, what are you doing, or anything like that, because we had a Disney tour guide taking us. But it was just sort of bizarre the way, you know, we would use employee-only areas in the back, you know, behind the rides and stuff like that to cross one area from another, you know, to sort of save on time. And yeah, I mean, and just to meet, you know, sort of there were long lines to meet the different characters, like to meet Mickey Mouse or Minnie Mouse. And, you know, we would just walk in, and next thing you know, my daughter was meeting Mickey Mouse. And at one point, Kelly, our guide, carried my daughter around. My daughter at the time was, about 5. And, you know, she'd get tired. And so she carried her around just to keep her energy up. I mean, these people will do anything for you. It was almost like Pharaoh in Egypt.
That one thing is that really got to me, right? That, I mean, it's nice of her, but the fact that she just
right.
picked up your daughter, you know, having been with kids in a park like this, that is a, if I had somebody like that with me, with my nephew around, let's say, that would be a lifesaver.
Yeah. No, and you know, my daughter, you know, 5-year-old's not light. I don't know, maybe 50, 60 pounds.
Right.
So, yeah, it was just pretty incredible. And I was just struck by, like, going up the back way, you know, or going, you know, up the side door, like the cast member's door, you know, just that kind of thing, you know, is crazy. I mean, Disney is interesting because they have a little bit more of an ambivalent relationship about all the privileges and, you know, tiering than, say, Universal or Six Flags, because Walt Disney felt like, you know, class divisions were something that existed outside the park. There shouldn't be this, you know, inside the park. So that's why everybody gets a few fast passes. So everybody can jump the line at some point, makes it a little more egalitarian. But the VIP tour is beyond that. And you really can cover a lot more ground with the VIP tour. I mean, just, you know, you don't have to wait at the gate, you know, of the park. And like when you want to go between Magic Kingdom and Epcot and that kind of thing, again, you use the back ways and the ways that the cast members use. And it just, it's a whole different experience. And I mean, that's sort of like what being rich in America is like today. I mean, it's a whole different experience.
I mean, one of the things that to go to this Disneyland example is, I think in your book you write, it's not easily accessible. You can't go on a website and click, you know, I want the VIP tour. Here's my $8,000 for the day or whatever. Thanks very much. I mean, the access to the Velvet Rope is obscured. I think at Disneyland, in some cases, and in many other, like Coachella is another example that you provide, where it's kind of the people that are getting this elite experience. You can kind of see them. You kind of get glimpses at them. But they're really segmented off for the most part in many of these environments.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Disney, they keep this in the fine print. It's not so obvious. It's, you know, it is sort of segmented off to the side. It's a real contrast to Six Flags and Universal, where it's right on the website and you can get the platinum and skip the line, you know, get platinum level tickets and skip the line. I think that in Coachella, yeah, it's sort of somewhat obscured. And I think there is a sort of, you know, among the people doing this, there is a desire for privacy or maybe a little bit of shame that they're kind of bypassing, you know, that they're jumping the line.
What would you just say to somebody who says the Velvet Rope economy is a natural state of affairs? Big deal.
I guess, you know, my thing is, look, I'm not Bernie Sanders. I'm not calling for socialism in America, but I do think when things get so tiered and so stratified, you have much less of a sense that we're all in it together. And there's much less of a sense of national unity or comity. And, you know, some of the divisions we have in our country, I think, you know, even in terms of the candidates that you see connecting with people, whether it's Trump or Sanders, I think anger, you know, really plays into that. And there's a lot of resentment and anger in the body politic today. And I think this, you know, accentuates that. And yes, it's always been around to some extent, but when you have 9 different groups to board a plane and that, you know, that this is on American Airlines, and the 9th group, which is known to the flight attendants, is group 9, because they come aboard. Wow. They're so angry at having waited all that time and they can't find a spot to check their bags in the overhead compartment. You know, I just think, what does that do to our society when we don't have a feeling of being in it together? And I think you see that with the coronavirus situation, where you get a lot of stories about wealthy people, athletes, movie stars, able to get tests and ordinary people not being able to get tests. So I think, or, you know, there's a sense that, you know, that we're not all in it together. And I think that really, that's the net result of the Velvet Rope economy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, speaking of the coronavirus, you know, based on your research, do you think that, I mean, who knows what things are like at the present moment? We're, you know, we're in May recording this, but May 2020. But do you think that post-coronavirus will accelerate this trend towards exclusivity and access? Or do you think that we will become more egalitarian as a result of the experience we've had with the coronavirus?
I think we might get more sort of more elite and, you know, more bound by class division.
Really?
Yeah, in terms of medicine, I think a lot of people are going to get concierge doctors. I think people are going to want that kind of access, and you maybe felt caught short in this situation.
The concierge doctors portion was, for me at least, particularly galling. I mean, the rest of the stuff I can understand, but when it comes to healthcare, you know, when I was, and I listened to the audiobook, and when I was listening to that portion of the book, I was thinking every time one of these physicians, you know, they're very careful as to how they do it ethically based on how you describe it, but every time they kind of cut the line, so to speak, and they call upon the resources of an oncologist, there's somebody, or maybe even tens of somebodies, who are not getting access to that oncologist anymore, right? How is something like that... How is that allowed? I mean, are there no regulations around that? And can you explain the concierge doctor concept as well?
Sure. I mean, I wrote about very elite concierge doctors who, you know, it could be $50,000 or $60,000 a year. You know, not, you know, $5,000 or $6,000. So sort of the top level. And, you know, a regular concierge doctor, maybe you get their cell phone number, and maybe they you know, call you to check in periodically. This is sort of, you know, much more service-oriented relationship. I mean, you get like quarterly reports like you would from your broker. But what really counts is that they can get you in with a specialist in a matter of days, whereas you might be waiting weeks or months to see a specialist if you didn't have a concierge doctor. And I guess it's based, you know, in terms of it being legal, it's not based on payment. I mean, the concierge doctors aren't getting paid or they're not paying the specialists, but they have relationships. And, you know, like everything else, you know, every other profession, medicine relationships are important. And they're able to get you in when you need to see someone. And I think that's very valuable. And, you know, you may have also read in the book about high-end, you know, college counselors, same kind of thing. Right. I mean, they have sort of what I call asymmetric information that can be, you know, very helpful, it's a limited range of circumstances, but that information is very helpful.
That part really made me feel like I almost kind of pitied my younger self. You know, here I am busting my chops, working on a personal statement. I'm an immigrant. My parents are immigrants. You know, we think we're doing great. You know, and I eventually got into a good school. But then there's somebody else, the way you described it, where they're paying upwards of $100,000 to have former admissions counselors read and help revise their personal statements. I mean, there's no comparison to somebody who's making a middle income. I mean, they're spending two times the median income of a family just to get one child a leg up into getting into an elite Ivy League.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, and what I was really struck by was the idea that this firm, IvyWise, hired former Ivy League admissions officers. So they would know, this is where the asymmetric information comes into play. They would know what sort of the dean of admissions at Yale sort of might say, oh, the dean of admissions is really into Southeast Asia. We suggest you do a summer trip to Cambodia and write about that for your essay. You know, that'll appeal to them. Yeah. Or they'll say, oh, you know, the football team, you know, needs a quarterback, or soccer team needs a goalie. Just knowing that information is really, really helpful.
So at the end of your book, right, you present kind of this epilogue, kind of this like upward positive note kind of chapter. And in that portion of the book, you discuss, I guess, companies and organizations that are still making a profit, doing well by their shareholders, but they're also relatively egalitarian. And in fact, you present some examples of companies that are not only making a profit, but they're doing really well, better than their competitors. Can you share some examples of that? I thought that was fascinating, that chapter.
Yeah. I think the one that jumps out is Southwest, the airline. Southwest does not have classes, and it's the most profitable airline in U.S. history. I actually read that it's actually positioned to come out of the COVID situation relatively well, at least compared to its peers. And it's, you know, it's always had an egalitarian ethos, and they show it. You can make plenty of money and do very, very well without being as, you know, ruthlessly tiered as sort of American airlines say. That was one example. Another one I look at is the Green Bay Packers, which is fan-owned. And, you know, they redid the stadium a few years ago, and they kept some of the best seats in the house for ordinary fans. I mean, it didn't all get sort of luxury boxed. And I think they tried to keep a little bit of an egalitarian ethos. I mean, it has blue-collar roots in terms of Packers in a packing plant, you know, putting up the money for the, you know, first team, you know, 100 years ago. And I think they try to keep that everyman quality at the stadium. Whereas, like, Levi's Stadium with San Francisco 49ers is totally honeycombed with different corporate suites and sort of, you know, the sort of the elite of Silicon Valley. So you really see a difference there. And then I look, you know, even in sports that can seem kind of elite, there's room for, again, a more egalitarian experience. I look at Bandon Dunes, which is a golf course in Oregon,
right,
and the owner kind of tries to keep the fees reasonable in terms of golfers. So, you have super elite golfing experiences like Augusta National, you know, the club that hosts the Masters. But this guy wanted to sort of have a really quality golf course that was within reach of ordinary people, and he's doing it, you know, and it can be done.
Yeah, I guess it just requires a lot more intention behind it, and maybe a little bit of a risk. You know, you might have to take a risk, and the risk being that your shareholders may not want that. They may want the easy profits that come from subdividing a plane into 10 different classes, you know?
Yeah. Although Southwest, I mean, they, like I said, I just read an analyst note saying they're poised to come out of this in a fairly strong position. So, right. I mean, they've been successful for a long time, kind of, you know, treating everybody equally.
Can I ask a very in the weeds kind of question? What if everybody did what Southwest does? Let's say all the airlines did that. In other words, is Southwest only doing well and making a profit because it's an outlier and it's doing something, it's providing a service for a community of flyers that the other airlines are not? And were they to provide, be exactly the same, you know, maybe then the airline that would do well would be the only one that was doing classes. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think if everyone was like Southwest, you'd have an airline come along and do different classes. I mean, for people who could afford it, business class and first is nice. I guess my feeling is you don't have to get rid of business and first. It doesn't have to be that. It's just, can you have a reasonable experience in coach? That, you know, or does it have to be a brutal, assaultive one like we have now?
And that's kind of, I guess, what you were saying throughout your book. You talk about in the 50s and 60s and even the 70s, you had those kind of velvet rope environments be smaller both in size and in intensity, right? So you had some of them, but they were just smaller in scope and also just not as an intense of an experience, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was just, it was a little less assaultive than at the bottom end than it is now. That I'd say is the difference.
So if you're I'll ask this question from the perspective of two different kinds of people. First of all, if you're a policymaker, a elected representative, somebody who has some power over how our economy functions, after you read this book, you know, what do you hope that person takes away from your book? And then secondly, you're an ordinary person. You're on the other side of the velvet rope. You know, you are the person in Disneyland who's going through the regular line. What power, if any, do they have over creating kind of a more just and fair economy, or just or fair world?
I guess, you know, I would hope that a person in a decision-making context would want to kind of invest in public spaces and would want to create, you know, sort of, let's say, schools that were adequately funded, that where you didn't have to have pay to play. Like, one thing I write about is sort of the fees for sports in public schools. So maybe if schools were better funded, you wouldn't have to rely on that, and then a lot more kids could play. So, I mean, just have them think about, you know, what happens when people are so segregated and there's less of a sense of that we're all in it together. I'd say that. And in terms of the person who's enjoying this, you know, think about what, you know, what they're missing out on and sort of not having more of a sense of being all in it together. When I went to Yankee Stadium and sat in the elite box, I mean, I noticed people were not that into the game. Everybody was looking at their phones. Mm-hmm. You know, there is something lost when you don't have a group experience, you know, all Americans in it together.
It's almost dystopian the way you describe that, the games, right? And I've been in a box like that once through a friend. And you're right, nobody pays attention to the game. Maybe, you know, right at the end or something. But nobody's really paying any attention at all to the game. It's kind of a networking opportunity. In fact, it probably accelerates the underlying causes, the underlying reasons why people are in that velvet rope box anyway.
Yeah, that's what I noticed. I mean, I noticed there, you know, it seems like, you know, in these elite boxes, there's a kind of underpowered quality to it. I think, you know, there are places that are, have an energy to them, like New York City, when we're not suffering from the coronavirus. I think New York City is a place where people of all different classes come together in some areas, like the subway, like Broadway, like other places, Times Square, and there's an energy to it. And, you know, that's what it means to be in a republic. You know, republic comes from res publica, public things. And I think when things are so segregated, that's lost.
What's, you know, you talk about, one example you use is when you call, and this applies to so many people, I think it's fascinating, when I call my bank for tech support or a billing problem or something, if I am a wealthy or, you know, well-capitalized bank customer, I get, without even knowing that this is happening to me, I get shunted to the front of the line. And I get better service, right? I might get a better call operator, get, you know, have to not wait in the queue on the tech support line. So first of all, it'd be great to hear just a little bit about that story. But then what do you think about the role technology is playing in, you know, moving that rope up even higher, making it even thicker overall in all parts of the economy?
Sure. One thing that I discovered was that, you know, when you assume when you call a customer service line for a credit card or a bank or insurance, it's your call is answered in the order it's received. But in fact, that's not the case. We all have what's called a CLV or a customer lifetime value. And that's based on, you know, maybe how much our balance is on the credit card or how much we have in the bank or how much the property that's insured is. And that CLV can determine how quickly your call is answered. If you have a high CLV, you are shunted right to the front of the line and your call is answered more quickly. It's answered by someone with more training.
Wow.
And that sort of is an invisible velvet rope, but very noticeable in terms of how you're treated as a consumer. And again, you know, I think that really segregates people and kind of creates a kind of a two Americas in terms of service. And whereas if you're not, you know, an elite customer, you really get, you know, second class service.
And this just keeps, you know, making the problem worse, right? Because if you're getting, if you're waiting an hour on the phone line and you're already a middle income person, now you have less time to, you know, prepare for work or schooling or, you know, contribute to the activities that would move you up maybe economically on the on your pay scale or something like that, you know, get some training or whatever the case may be in the aggregate, if you're wasting time doing these things.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
All right. Well, Nelson, thanks for joining us. I know you're pretty busy, so I appreciate you taking the time. Your book was fantastic. It's I highly, highly recommend it. I finished it very quickly, and I think it's really well written, and I think you did a fantastic job kind of summarizing these issues for a lay audience. You know, I learned a lot. You know, and I study these things, and I learned a lot.
Oh, great. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Thanks again for joining. Stay safe.
And, you too.
You know, look forward to reading your next book.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for your time. Yeah. I really appreciate your interest.
Absolutely. Pleasure. Thanks for writing the book. Great. Hey, thanks for listening to another episode of Unfair Nation. You can support us by subscribing to our podcast and leaving a review on your favorite podcast app. Our coverage of coronavirus-related stories continues, and our next guest is going to be Jamie Harrison. He's running for the U.S. Senate seat against Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. We'll be talking to him about why he's running and how issues related to inequality, rights, and community needs factor into his campaign. A special thank you to Nicole Anselmo for her help in co-producing this podcast, Rima Hebrawi for her feedback and advice, and my brother-in-law, who somehow manages to snag the phone numbers of all of the important people in the world. As always, thank you so much for listening, and stay safe.